meditation to calm our mind, and then I'll talk a little bit about grief and loss, and then we can have Q&A after that. Okay? Okay, so sit up straight, lower your eyes, have your hands in your lap. And begin by simply feeling yourself sitting here on the cushion or on the chair. And bring your mind here to where your body is. So don't go to tomorrow, don't go to yesterday. Stay right here. And then briefly, just scan your body, see if there's tension or tightness anywhere. And if there is, then let it go. Then become aware of your breath. Letting your breathing pattern be quite natural. Don't force it. But observe your breath. What's happening as you inhale? What's happening as you exhale? And you can do this by focusing on your belly, watching the rise and fall of your belly, or focusing on the nostrils and the upper lip, observing the sensation of the air as it passes there. So pick one of the two places. And then just observe your breath, experience your breath. See the unique qualities about each breath. If you start thinking about something else and get distracted by a sound or a thought or a sensation, just notice that, but come home to your breath. And so in that way, let your mind settle down by keeping it on one object, in this case, the breath. So let's do that for a few minutes. Cultivate our motivation and think that we will listen attentively and share in the Dharma this evening as we talk about grief and loss, realizing that it is a natural part of samsaric life. but also using it as an impetus to help us seek liberation from the cycle of existence. And by realizing that everybody is caught in this cycle of grief and loss and change, generate the bodhicitta, the loving, compassionate, altruistic intention to become a Buddha for the benefit of all beings. So let's have that be our long-term motivation for sharing together this evening. Okay. So grief and loss really are part of our life, aren't they? Yeah. And the Buddha's first teaching that he gave when he taught the Four Noble Truths in Sarnath, the very first part of the Four Noble Truths is about impermanence. So they say impermanence, change, transience was the Buddha's first teaching. And it was also his last teaching that he demonstrated by passing away himself. And to really emphasize to us that this is the nature of our being in cyclic existence. So it's not something that we like, yeah? And in fact, one of our greatest misconceptions, they often talk about the four distorted conceptions. And one of them, the first one, is seeing things that are impermanent as permanent. So things that have the nature of momentary change as being static. And although intellectually we know that things are changing, and certainly science tells us that, you know, that the atoms, you know, the components of the atoms are changing and, you know, position and rising and falling, and even when they talk about some of the subatomic particles, it seems like some of them go in and out of existence. I don't quite understand that. But, you know, change is there at a very subtle level and also at a very gross level. So the gross level change is what we can see with our eyes. Yeah, something falls down, okay? A person dies. You spill spaghetti sauce on the new carpet. Yeah, your car gets scratched. Your new car gets scratched. Okay, so this is gross change that we can all see. Yeah. But gross change can't happen unless there's subtle change. And subtle change, subtle impermanence, we can't see with our eyes. Yeah, and it is simply the nature of conditioned things, things that arise due to causes and conditions, that they don't remain the same in the very next moment. Okay? So, for example, the sun rising and the sun setting are gross impermanence, but they couldn't happen without the subtle impermanence of every single split second, the sun changing and the earth changing. But we don't notice those split second changes, but the gross changes couldn't happen, gross changes that we see couldn't happen without those subtle ones. Okay. So even though You know, we look in the mirror yesterday, we look in the mirror today. It seems like we look the same. We haven't aged between yesterday and today. Yeah. But actually, the process of subtle impermanence is there, because who we were yesterday was gone. You know, moment by moment, the life span getting used up, approaching death. Yeah. And it's because of that momentary change that, you know, we started out being this big, yeah, and we grew to a baby, got born, you know, grew to a toddler and a child and an adolescent and a young adult and a middle-aged person and a senior citizen, and then finally we die, yeah? So that whole change that's occurring every moment in our lifespan that we don't notice unless it's been a good chunk of time, then all that is made possible simply because of the momentary change that's going on. So it's not that things arise and then they stay fixed for a moment and then they change. Yeah. We often have this idea of, like with the flowers, they grow, then they stay for a while, and then they die. But it's not actually like that, because every moment of growing, they are changing. Every moment where they're abiding, they're changing. And then every moment when they're dying, they're changing. Nothing is there the same in the very next moment. Okay, so like I said, it's not something that we like, because we usually think of impermanence in the sense of loss and death, okay? We should also note, however, that it's because of impermanence that we can become Buddhas. Because if our mind were not impermanent, then it would be fixed. It could never change. Our afflictions would always be there. Our good qualities would always be tiny, and the good qualities couldn't grow, and the antidotes couldn't be applied to reduce the afflictions. So it's important to remember that change, the nature of change, also means that we can become Buddhas, yeah, that we can improve, that things are not fixed. Okay. However, as samsaric beings, we tend to be very attached to whatever is appearing to us at that very moment, especially if it's something we like. So if there's something we like, our mind sees it as somehow fixed and not changing. Yeah. Even things we don't like, when we're in a bad mood, when we're feeling depressed, we look at our depression as if it's permanent and unchanging. But that's actually quite unrealistic, because it too is changing moment by moment. Okay? Very important to realize this. None of these things are fixed. But when we get attached to something that we like and think, oh, this is going to last for a long time, yeah, like our health, or our youth, or a relationship that we really like, or a certain status that we have, when we have the misconception, the distorted idea that this is going to keep going on without changing, then when the gross change happens, we freak out. Yeah? So we see this. Even, yeah, you have a parent that's elderly, or a friend who is very ill with a disease, you know they're going to die soon, but every day that they wake up, they don't think, today is the day I'm going to die. And we don't think, today is the day they're going to die. We keep thinking they will die soon, but it won't be today. But certainly, one of those days, they're going to wake up and they're going to die. And even when they die, we're so surprised, even though we know they're going to die. Yeah. So this is true for people who are elderly, who are sick, let alone for people we know who are young and who die in accidents. Yeah. Or get some kind of disease and die very quickly. And we're always so shocked, like, this shouldn't happen. It's not supposed to be like this. Do you find in your life that that's your often your reaction to this kind of change? My father died last June. He was going to be 93 on June 25th. On June 23rd, all the nuns at the Abbey called him to wish him a happy birthday. He had been up to visit us, and he has a very good sense of humor. So everybody in the Abbey wanted to be there and wish him happy birthday, and we had a really nice conversation. And he was fine. I mean, he was going to be 93. He has some dementia. He blacks out from time to time, but, you know, he's still kind of strong. And the three of us siblings had always been talking, you know, Dad's going to die soon. We're all completely aware of it, talked about it. So that was June 23rd. June 24th, my sister and her kids, who live in the same house with my dad, they had a party for Dad for his 93rd birthday. And so my sister and her kids and her boyfriend and his kids came over. They made Dad's favorite food. Everybody was so excited. Dad is going to have such a good time at his birthday party. Yeah. So they're sitting there having dinner. They made some steak, which Dad really likes. He cut a piece of steak up, put it in his mouth, choked on it, couldn't breathe, turned blue, fell off the chair, and was dead within minutes. Yeah? They tried to do Heimlich's, you know? Heimlich? Yeah? Couldn't dislodge it. So like that, at his birthday party. Yeah? And when they called to tell me, yeah, that night, it was the next day I was going to have a colonoscopy. So if you've had a colonoscopy, you know what's happening the night before the colonoscopy. Yeah, I was busy. So I made it to the phone to hear, you know, them tell me this story. Yeah. And even though I had, you know, for years I've been thinking about my dad's death, planning, you know, everything, my first thought was, but I just talked to him yesterday. Yeah. And he was fine. You know, when my brother said, Dad's dead, but I just talked to him yesterday. I mean, it didn't come out of my lips because the thought formulated in my mind, and I have enough practice to say dumb thought, you know. Don't even say it. That's a ridiculous thought. But it was interesting how it just came like that. Yeah? I just talked to him yesterday. How could he be dead? Because I had always had the idea, because he would fall often and black out, that's what would happen. He'd wind up in the hospital, and we'd wind up with one of these prolonged things, of him hooked onto machines and being unconscious. That's what I thought would happen. I'm glad that that didn't happen. Of course, I'm not glad he died. But, you know, at least we didn't have to deal with that, you know, prison thing. Hospital prison, you know. Would they keep you prison in the hospital? They won't let you go, even though you want to get out. So, so just like that, you know. So it's funny how, you know, the mind, we know intellectually, but when it happens, gone. And so what my dad gave me was this, I mean, this is a Lam Rim story, isn't it? You know, when they say the time of death is definite, the time of death is indefinite. Yeah, this is perfect example. One of the points under that, is that even the things we do to keep us alive kill us? It's exactly what happened. Yeah, when 911 came, they finally pulled out this big piece of meat from his throat. Yeah, so what I'm getting at is, you know, change is the reality of our existence. And yet, we're so shocked by it when it happens, when the gross change happens. Okay? And the more shocked we are, the more unhappy we're going to be. I mean, thank goodness with my dad, like I said, the thought came, but I didn't say it because immediately, you know, because of years of thinking, you know, my dad's going to die. I realized it's a stupid thought, yeah. But, you know, so often people don't think in advance of these kinds of things. And then when it happens, it's like complete chaos in the mind. How could this happen? This person's supposed to live forever. So the more surprised we are, the more we fight against the reality of impermanence, of gross impermanence, yeah? So when we don't think about it, when we don't accept it, when it happens, then the mind says, how can this happen? This wasn't supposed to happen, yeah? And I think what grief is it's a process of adjusting to a change that we did not want. Yeah? So I don't see grief as, you know, crying and going hysterical, although many people do that when they're grieving. But it's the process of adjusting to that change that we didn't want. So the more we reject the change, the more difficult it is when it happens. And for sure, it's going to happen. Yeah. So the more we can be familiar with it, the easier the change is, the easier it is to accept it. Okay. So this is something that the Buddha tells us, like I said, his first teaching, his last teaching. He told us all the way in between, too. Yeah, especially those, you know, any of you have studied the Lam Rim? So in the path of the middle capable being, we study a lot about impermanence, transient nature, okay? But we don't like to meditate on that. Death and impermanence comes in the practice in common with the initial capable being. We kind of skip over that meditation. It comes in the practice of the middle capable being. We again skip over it. Yeah. We want to meditate on life, light and love and bliss. Yeah. We want a wowie kazowie, you know, with sparkles and, you know, bliss energy and everything, yeah. But the Buddha taught the Four Noble Truths, and the first thing he taught was impermanence. And he taught it first because it's really essential for us to face that this is part of life in samsara. Because when we can face that, it gives us a lot of energy to be free of samsara. Because we come to see that whatever happiness we may have in samsara, in this cycle of rebirth that is under the control of ignorance, afflictions, and karma, while we're contained in that cycle, we're never going to have any lasting happiness. We will have bits of happiness and portions of happiness. We all know that. We've all had that. But we will never find lasting happiness. So the only lasting happiness that is to be found is when we are no longer conditioned by ignorance, afflictions, and karma. When we are no longer, you know, because conditioned means impermanent. And conditioned by ignorance doesn't sound very good, does it? Yeah. Conditioned by wisdom, that's okay. Yeah. A Buddha is conditioned, you know, a Buddha's mind is also transient and impermanent. But it's the nature of wisdom. So that kind of change, you know, it just changes, the Buddha's mind changes in that he sees different things in every moment. But his realizations never decline because there's no cause for a Buddha's realizations to decline. But for us, yeah, conditioned by ignorance, we're never going to find any lasting security. Yeah. So the more we understand impermanence and reflect on it and accept it, the less surprised we will be when gross impermanence happens. The more flexible our mind will be and we'll be able to adapt to that change. And the more we will actually see the value in practicing the Dharma in order to attain liberation and awakening, where we will be free of this impermanent nature that is conditioned by ignorance and afflictions. Okay, you with me here? Yeah. So that's the big picture, the Buddhist picture. And when you really delve into it in depth, it can be very, very helpful. Yeah. Because I know that for me, I've spent years thinking, you know, first, you know, thinking about my parents' death, thinking about my own death, thinking about my teachers passing away, thinking about my friends passing away. It's not morbid, yeah? If you think about it correctly, it is not morbid. It's simply reality. Okay, and so I think about it for the purpose of becoming used to that idea, knowing that unless I die first, I will have to face these situations. Yeah, and it really helps. Yeah, it helps tremendously. When my mom died, yeah, even though then too, you know, because my mom had been sick for a long time. There were so many crises. She's in the hospital. She's out of the hospital. She's in the hospital. She's out of the hospital. You know? So here's another one. We don't know. Is she going to die this time or not? I'm living in Washington State. She lives in California. Do I go down? Do I not go down? You know? I actually had shingles at the time, so even if I wanted to go, I couldn't go. Yeah. So that, you know, although there had been many crises before, there was one that was the time when she died. Yeah. But because I had thought about it a lot beforehand, it wasn't a surprise. Yeah. And she had been in the hospital. So it wasn't like my dad who was not in the hospital, you know. So I was, you know, kind of expecting it, although hoping it wouldn't. And many previous crises it hadn't. Yeah. But it helps tremendously to have thought about these things and accepted their reality. And I think also with our own death, you know, when it's there. So, because death is actually a natural part of life. It's not a morbid topic. It's reality. Yeah, it's total reality. And the thing is that we're going towards death beginning in the moment after we've been conceived in our mother's womb. So beginning with the moment after conception, death is approaching. Yeah. It's just nature. Yeah. Some people, you can see, like if you ever do, if you're ever a hospice chaplain or work in a hospital as a chaplain, people sometimes see death as a punishment. Some people who follow theistic religions where there's a creator God often will see death as a punishment. You did something wrong, so God is punishing you and you're dying. Buddhists do not see death like that. It is not a punishment. It's just what happens to everybody, including the Buddha himself. It's not a punishment. It's not a failure. It's a natural part of living. Yeah? And death then brings about rebirth. But it's very funny, when a baby is born, we say how wonderful. But that baby's actually in the process of dying. And when they die, we say how terrible. Yeah? And it all has to do with our mind and how we conceive and think about these different things. Okay? So one way of looking at it, you know, we've all died infinite, you know, countless times before. Death isn't something new. We've had beginningless previous lifetimes, you know, and they've ended and we've died and we've been reborn. So it's not like some new experience. But because we don't think about it, and, you know, because we're attached to the things in this life, therefore, death becomes scary for us, okay? So it's the attachment that makes death scary because, you know, at the time of death, we separate from this body, you know, this body that we've been with our entire life, that we've pampered and catered to. At the end of the day, you know, it's like a hotel room that we move out of. And we're still living in this hotel room now. We're going to get an eviction notice. Yeah. But we don't know when. And we, you know, the consciousness moves out of the body. You know, in the 37 practices of bodhisattvas, there's the phrase, you know, the mind leaves the guest house of the body. Yeah. Just goes. But if we're attached to the body, then separating from the body is scary. And especially if our concept of who we are is very involved with the notion of our body. And if we look, a lot of our identity is linked up with our body. Yeah? Being male or female is a very basic part of our identity, yeah? When we're born, what's the first question? When a baby is born, what's the first question people ask? Boy or girl? Yeah? So that's part of the identity there, but it's gone, yeah? We may have a cultural identity or a racial identity or a sexual orientation identity, or a national identity. Yeah, this or an education identity, or a socioeconomic class identity, or a religious identity. Most of these identities, not all of them, but many of them, are based on the body, aren't they? And we have these identities that we just carry on with in our life. Sometimes we don't realize them. If you're in the majority part of the population, you often don't realize how your body makes that identity. If you're white in America, you don't realize how much being white is part of your identity, because it's the minority, it's the majority identity. Yeah. If you go live in Africa or in Asia, you become very aware that you're white. Yeah? And that you look different than other people. If you're black in this country, or brown, or yellow, or whatever it is, if you're a minority, you tend to be more conscious. Yeah? Same, you know, so there's a racial identity that is based on this body. Yeah, there's a sexual identity. There's a sexual orientation identity based on the body. There's a national identity. Yeah, I'm American. Yeah, when my body shows up at immigration, you know, I'm American. Why am I American? Yeah, because I have a piece of paper that says American on it. Yeah, actually, there's no part of my body that's American. Yeah, no part of my body that's American. But I have an American passport, you know, and the passport lets this body cross this line. Yeah? So there's that kind of identity. So, and then there's ethnic identities that are very often based on this body. Okay. So, you know, when we're attached to this body at the time of death, when we're losing it, then all of a sudden we may feel, oh, I'm losing my identity. Whether you have, you know, whatever your identity is. Yeah. And also on the basis of this body, you know, we have a social life and we're embedded in families and different groups. And when we die, all of that evaporates also. Yeah. So that identity evaporates. So when we haven't meditated on emptiness and our identity begins to evaporate at the time of death, the self-grasping ignorance goes, but I'm holding on to that identity. I want to be somebody. I am somebody. If I don't have that body and that whatever else we assume is our identity, if I don't have that, I won't exist. Okay, so in the 12 links of dependent arising, which some of you have studied, these are the links of craving and clinging. And they're what make ripen whatever karma is, you know, ready to be, is most prominent. And then that karma ripens and we're attracted to our next birth. And that's how rebirth occurs. Okay. So the more we're familiar with meditating on emptiness, the more we are familiar with the idea that I am not my body and that I have all these different social identities, but I am not any of them. Yeah? People think of me as a woman. Actually, my identity, yeah, it's only a label given on the basis of the body, but I am not my body. Why cling to that identity? Okay, you getting what I'm saying? So all the different identities, I'm so-and-so's mother, father, sister, brother, husband, wife, you know, boyfriend, girlfriend, friend, whatever, actually we're not any of those things. Yeah, it's just there's a conventional situation. We're, you know, a certain relationship is given a certain name, but none of those things are who we are. In fact, we can't find anything that we can draw a circle around and say, that's who I am. So when the Buddha talks about not self or selflessness, this is what he's getting at. There is no soul. There is no essence of the person. There is no independent self that picks up out of this body that is permanent and unchanging and just hops over to another body and plops itself in. There's nothing like that. Okay? There's a person, there's a self, but it exists by being merely designated. When you look for what it is, it cannot be found. Yeah, but it exists in dependence on name and concept. Okay, so there's the continuity of the person that goes on, but there is nothing permanent that is the person that continues. There's the continuity of changing moments, yeah, that have the relationship of cause and effect. But none of those moments is an independent identity of who we are. Okay? We're Tibetan Buddhists, so we're very familiar with the idea of identifying the incarnate lamas. Somebody was a great master in one life, we identify the child in the next life. Yeah. So because of this, even though we speak about selflessness, in the back of our mind, there's a soul. Yeah, there's something that's really my teacher, that, okay, it's in this body, that's really my teacher. The body dies, they find the child, same person. Not same person, different aggregates. Yeah, the person exists in dependence on the aggregates, is imputed in dependence on the aggregates. The aggregates have changed. It's a different person. I remember when, you know, the first time in the early 80s, several of my teachers died, one right after the other, and then the children were found, you know, later. And I remember everybody was going, did he recognize you? You know, did you recognize him? And I thought, what kind of dumb question is that? You know? Yeah, there's nothing permanent that went from one life to the other. Why do I think I'm so important that, you know, any memories of a past life of my teacher are going to include me? You know? That's not so realistic. But people, you know, think, oh, it's the same person. When we talk about the general I, yeah, the general I is that continuity that goes over many, many lifetimes. But the individual I of each lifetime is a different person. it's not inherently different because there is the continuity, but it's not the same person. Has a different name, has different aggregates. Okay? So even though when somebody dies, we'll say, you know, oh, do you still feel that person somewhere around? Yeah. As if, you know, it's the same person somewhere around. But the aggregates aren't the same. Body's different. Yeah, they're in the bardo. They have bardo aggregates now. Okay. There may be some energy still, yeah. But it's not exactly the same. It's not the same person. Okay, and sometimes that's hard to let go of, hard to realize, you know. And people really put all their energy into the body, you know, because the body is what they can see, and they think, oh, that will connect me to the person who died, seeing the body. Yeah, and it's so interesting, isn't it? How, even in some of the airplane crashes that have happened this year, what's been so important is to find the bodies and to bring the bodies back to the relatives. And it's said that when that happens, that brings closure. So I suppose for regular people who don't think about death and who don't think about emptiness, you know, the body is what reminds you of the person, you know. But for me, I always think when the consciousness left the body, who in the world cares what happens to the body? It's just me, not a person, you know. And so in ancient Tibet, they used to take the bodies up on the top of a hill and let the vultures eat them. I would be very happy if that happened when I died, but I don't think American law permits that. Yeah, but I figure, you know, when the consciousness is gone, what is the value of this? You know, I'd much rather have some sentient being benefit from it. Because it's just a glob of vegetable goo. That's it. Yeah. And yet we see people who are so attached to that body. Wasn't there some movie star who died recently who had a facelift before she died so that she would look good in her coffin? Yeah? Does anybody remember? I read it in the news. Anybody remember who it was?
Joan Rivers.
Joan Rivers, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah? Can you believe that? Had a face, you know, a facelift before she died so that she would look beautiful in her coffin.
That's likely a joke of hers, though.
Yeah. Yeah, but I wouldn't be surprised if someone somewhere did it. Yeah? I remember when I was 20, about 20, 21, my friend's mother, who had had Hodgkin's, died, and I went to the funeral, and I heard people say, you know, because I don't know what they did, but they were saying, she hasn't looked so good in a long time. Yeah, she's dead. They say she looked, you know, she hasn't looked that good in a long time. Kind of amazing, isn't it? How attached we are to the body. Yeah. Yeah, and people die in one place. We will transport the body to another place to bury it. So Yeah, I really want to emphasize again that talking about death is not morbid. It's just reality. In our culture, we don't like to talk about death. We don't like to look at death. We hide it. Yeah. When you go to India, you see it. You go to the train station, sometimes there is a dead body right there in the train station. Or you're riding on a bus to Benares, and they take a lot of people. The Hindus want to take the corpses to Benares to be in the Ganges River. They consider it a blessing. And so there will be a truck or a bus, you know, that you're looking out at with a body on it. The family's taking the body to Benares where the Ganges is. Okay? But we hide it. And, you know, Forest Lawn, I heard that, I don't know, is Forest Lawn big here or is it only like out in California? In California, it's a really big chain of cemeteries. And they made some of them into like an art museum and a picnic place, you know, so that you can go have a family outing so that it's not such a terrible thing. You know, some way to hide death. And I remember being a little kid. Do you remember being little and asking your parents about death? Yeah? When a pet died or a grandparent died or, you know, a friend died, somebody died. And I remember, you know, driving past Forest Lawn and, you know, what's that? Oh, it's a cemetery. What's that? It's for dead people. What's that? Silence. You know, like, don't ask that question. Because if you talk about death, it might happen. The corollary being, if you don't talk about it, it won't happen. That's how resistant we are to thinking about change. Okay? So, that's talking about the change part of it. Now, the grief and the loss. So, like I said, I think grief is adapting to a process of change that we didn't expect, want, or bring about. Yeah. So, death isn't the only big change. The divorce rate in this country is like, you know, it's way over half, isn't it? Yeah, of marriages, people get divorced. Divorce is not a pleasant thing, is it? Yeah, it's not a pleasant thing. And there's often a feeling of great loss. What usually happens in divorce is one person is kind of ready to move on and the other person isn't. So the person who is ready to move on, you know, brings about the divorce because they're ready to do something different. It's not so difficult for them to transition to being single or whatever they happen to do afterwards. But for the person who didn't want the divorce, who wasn't expecting it, yeah, it's a huge shock and a huge loss. Yeah, that people can be. I've talked to many people, and they had no idea that their spouse was going to ask for a divorce until their spouse did. It took them totally by surprise. Yeah, and they're sitting there like, you know. So there's a tremendous feeling of loss. And I think in the case of divorce and also in the case of death, you know, when people are married, their identities kind of get very dependent and mixed in with each other. Yeah. You can see at social gatherings, a married couple, they usually go together. They will sit next to each other. They will do things together. Even though they live with each other and see each other all the time. When they're out somewhere, they're together. Somehow, the identities are very much dependent on the other person. And when there's divorce or death, then your identity is like, well, who am I if I'm not this person's husband, wife, you know, partner, whatever it is? Yeah. And people have to kind of learn to create a different identity of being a single person. And they have to, in many ways, learn to do things that they didn't have to do when they were married. Yeah? Because usually when you're married, one person handles the money and the other person doesn't know the least bit about it. Yeah? Or one person handles the car insurance. The other person doesn't know about it. You know, so there's all this thing when all of a sudden the relationship isn't there and you've got to do all these things for yourself again that you didn't have to do because your identity was very mixed with somebody else's identity. Yeah? So that's a period of adaptation that can be, you know, a little bit unnerving, I think. Especially if you say to yourself, I don't know how to balance a checkbook. Yeah, and there you are, you're the one who has to balance the checkbook. Yeah, so you have to learn new skills that you didn't know before, or that you knew, you know, 10, 20 years before, but because your partner took charge of this thing, you forgot in the meantime. Okay? So there's a lot of shift of identity, and it takes time to go through the grieving process. Many people think that when there's grief, when there's loss, that what we're longing for is the past. Yeah? Because we think of the past a lot when there's loss, don't we? I don't think we're really mourning the past. Because the past was and is no longer. It was there. We enjoyed what we enjoyed. We didn't enjoy what we didn't enjoy. You know, we have memories. But the past is not happening now. The present is vanishing in each moment. So we're not mourning the present either. I think what a lot of the grief is about is we had an idea of what the future was supposed to be, and our idea included this other person. And all of a sudden, that other person's not going to be in our future in the same way. So our expectation of the future, our image of what we thought the future was going to be, is not going to happen. So it's, I think what we actually are mourning is the loss of the idea of the future, which hasn't happened. So we're mourning something that doesn't exist. Except our thought of it existed. Are you getting what I mean? Yeah? It's like you think so-and-so is going to be in your future, you know, your brother, sister, whoever it is, your kid, you're going to have a future, you know, you have some idea of some things you want to do and what it's going to be like. And we hold on to those ideas. We solidify them. That's the conception of permanence again. Yeah, that conception, that distorted conception of permanence coming. Yeah, and we think that that idea, we expect that that idea will become a reality. But it's not going to. Yeah. So we're mourning What never has existed that won't exist. It's an interesting thing, isn't it? Yeah? Whereas if we didn't hang on to that concept of the future so tightly, then there wouldn't be so much to mourn. Mm-hmm. And we wouldn't be thrown so off base when that person is no longer there. Similarly, with, you know, losing your job, the economy changes, you lose your job, there's a sense of loss because our conception of permanence thought, I have a job and it's always going to be there. Yeah? No guarantee of that. But everything we look at that we like in our lives, and even the things we don't like, we think it's always going to be there. But it's not. So it would be very helpful for us to remember when we're in bad moods and when things we don't like happen, that we don't need to get too bummed out about them because the situation's going to change. It's not always going to be like that. Our mood is not always going to be what it is. And similarly, when there's something we like or some happy feeling, to not cling on to it too much or expect it to always be there, because it too is dependent on causes and conditions that are changing, and it's not going to be there forever. So having this kind of perspective enables us mentally, psychologically, to be a lot calmer. Yeah, not so up and down, but a lot calmer, and our mind is more flexible. It can adapt to things happening. Okay? So it's kind of like, you know, you're going to go on a flight, and you think the flight, you know, I'm going on a flight tomorrow. It's going to leave at 8:10. It's going to arrive at whatever it is. It's going to be on time. Yeah, right. You know, it's, you know, you always say, oh, it's going to be on time. I'm going to get off the plane and have this and this happen. Well, the flight might be delayed. The flight might be canceled. The flight might be who knows what. And you have to kind of be ready for it. Otherwise, you get so bummed out at the airport, and then you see the people screaming at the airport staff. Yeah, get me on a flight. Yeah, and what can these people do? Okay, so I talked a bit. Let's hear from you what your thoughts are, and if you have comments or questions or whatever. Yeah. Okay, so according to the tantric view, yeah, at the time of death, the gross consciousnesses are absorbing because the body, the elements of the body are growing weaker, so the body can no longer support the gross consciousnesses, like our sense consciousnesses. So when we're dying, you know, we lose the ability to see and hear and all these kinds of things. And then the mental consciousness gets subtler and subtler until it reaches an extremely subtle stage that is called the fundamental innate mind of clear light. Yeah. So this is an extremely subtle stage that is extremely subtle consciousness that is together with an extremely subtle wind energy. Yeah. This fundamental innate mind of clear light is changing moment by moment. Every consciousness changes moment by moment because a consciousness is an impermanent phenomena, which means it arises due to causes and conditions, specifically the moment of consciousness that existed before it. So we say that the actual moment of death is when this fundamental innate mind of clear light leaves the body, yeah, and then it gets a little bit grosser, and the wind energy gets a little bit grosser, and it goes into the bardo body, you know. And then when an appropriate gross body is found, it again dissolves and then again reappear, you know, goes into the gross body, and then the gross senses come back again, okay? So this fundamental innate mind of clear light that's together with the wind energy, yeah, it's not a soul, because a soul is something that's not only permanent, but truly existent. It is the fundamental essence of somebody. But this clear light mind, you know, is very subtle, and it's not inherently existent, and it's not permanent. Okay? It exists by being merely labeled. Yeah, it exists due to causes and conditions. It's changing in every moment. Okay? So it's not a soul. But that kind of forms the basis for the continuity that goes along. I think the example of a river can be very helpful to illustrate this. When, do you have a river around here? Is there?
Not as such.
Huh?
The Crooked River.
The Crooked River.
Cuyahoga. It's a Native American word that means Crooked River.
Ah, okay.
Cuyahoga.
Cuyahoga. Oh, I remember seeing that sign somewhere. Yeah, Cuyahoga. Okay. And where does it start here? Does it flow into the lake?
Into the lake.
And where does it start?
I don't know.
Somewhere.
Somewhere.
Somewhere. Yeah. And we can't probably actually find exactly where it starts, can we? Yeah. But in any case, it at some point, yeah, there's this water that's flowing along, and there's a bank and a bottom, and the water's flowing around, and then we say the Cuyahoga River. Okay. Yeah. And even though it's flowing here, and it's flowing here, and it flows there, we still give it the same name in all those different places. But is it the same upstream as it is downstream? No, because upstream it's probably several little trickles. Yeah, midstream there's more. The water is moving all the time, isn't it? You know, the water's moving, the atoms and molecules, you know, in the water are moving. The banks of the river are changing all the time. It's carrying silt in some places, carrying silt away from some places, leaving silt in other places. Yeah. So what we call the Cuyahoga River, yeah, it's one name. We think of it as one thing, but it's actually not one thing, is it? It's a whole bunch of different things. And we can't draw a circle around one part of the river or one location of the river and say, this is the Cuyahoga River and nothing else is. What it is there's just this continuity of water, dirt. There's some continuity, and cause and effect going on there. And because we give it one name, we think of it as one thing. But actually, it's many things. And actually, there's nothing we can find to identify as the Cuyahoga River. Okay? So it's the same thing with our mind stream. Yeah? There's this ever-changing, moment-by-moment thing of different levels of mind, some subtle, some very subtle, some gross, that have some kind of connection that keep going. Yeah? So on the basis of that, you know, that continuity from beginningless time till Buddhahood and beyond, that is what we call the general eye of the person. Yeah? And that's what enabled the Buddha, for example, to say, in my previous life, I did this, because there was some continuity in that ever-changing flow between the Buddha's present life and whoever he was in a past life. Yeah? And that's also what gives us the ability to say, when I was a child, is that there's some continuity going there. Okay. But when we look more specifically at one life and another life, each life has its own set of five aggregates. And so there's a different label, a different name given to each set of five aggregates. One lifetime, we say human being, because there's a human body and human mental aggregates. Another lifetime, we say animal, because there's an animal body and animal mental aggregates. Another lifetime, we say deva, because there is a deva's body and aggregates, you know, and mental aggregates, okay? All those different specific eyes are like members of the group that fall under that general eye. So like if you were to draw a Venn diagram a number line or a history thing, you could identify, you know, oh, human body, you know, there's Joe, there's Susan, there's Stormy the dog, there's Jody the cat, there's, you know, Frederick the grasshopper, there's, you know, and all of these going along, yeah. But they're all different people, and they're all in different realms, but there is some causal connection, and that is what enables karma that is created in one life to the result of that karma to be experienced in another life. But when we look to see who the person is, cannot find. Okay? Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so your question is kind of like, given that attachment is a hindrance and something to be abandoned on the path, how do we look at taking care of our present body and mind and attending to what's evident in this life? Yeah. Is that your question? Okay. So we take care of this body because it's the basis of our precious human life, and our precious human life is what allows us to create virtue and to practice the Dharma. And that creation of virtue, generation of wisdom, all the Dharma practice that we do based on our human aggregates is what will free us from samsara. So we take care of our present body and our present mind, you know, to keep them relatively healthy and flexible and serviceable so that we can use them to practice. But that is very different than taking care of our body and mind in a self-indulgent way. Okay? The self-indulgent way is, oh, I stubbed my little toe, it hurts so much. Everybody pay attention to me and help me because I'm crippled now that my toe is stubbed, please. You know, and I can't practice Dharma because my little toe hurts so badly. Okay? So that is attachment. Yeah? And that kind of attachment, we spend a lot of time and energy in that kind of attachment. Yeah? It's actually still possible to practice the Dharma even if your toe hurts. Yeah? It's really possible. But, you know, when we are very attached to our own comfort, the slightest little thing happens, and suddenly we go, I can't focus on the Dharma now because I have this pain. Or we have some really wonderful situation happens, you know, Prince Charming, Princess Charming, walk into the room, you fall in love, this is it. You've never been happier in your whole life. And all of a sudden, due to attachment, Dharma is out the window. Yeah? Isn't it? So this is the due to the force of attachment. Yeah. And that attachment is self-indulgence. Because you can still practice the Dharma when you're in a relationship. Yeah. What I've noticed is when people are single, when they get in a relationship, they stop practicing. When people are in a relationship and they separate, then they stop practicing. So whenever there's a change, all of a sudden, I can't practice the Dharma. Yeah, that's due to attachment. Mm-hmm. And so we have to learn to practice consistently, no matter what the situation is. Because, you know, someday we're going to be dying. And we're going to have to practice the Dharma then. And we're not going to be able to say, excuse me, Lord of Death, you know, I have a tummy ache today, I can't die. And I really want to be able to meditate when I'm dying. So please go away and come back when I feel better. So I can meditate and concentrate when I'm dying. Yeah, that's not going to happen. Okay? So we have to get used to, you know, doing our best and practicing however we can. You know, whenever a situation becomes either very difficult or very good.
Yeah. Right along those lines, I wanted to ask you a question. So, you know, I've been coming here for a while, and I've been studying different topics, and death and dying is like at the forefront at this point. But as much as I try, I'm not going to sit in meditation when I'm dying. And I'm not there. So for somebody like me, and I'm in that situation, and I'm on my deathbed, what do I do?
What do you do?
What do I do? Concretely, what do I do?
Okay. Concretely, as you're approaching death, first of all, you forgive everybody that you need to forgive. Okay? So that you just let go of all anger, resentment, and grudges. Whoever harmed me for whatever reason, I totally forgive them. And forgiving means I put my anger down. Then whoever I harmed, in my own mind, I apologize to that person. Not beating my chest saying how terrible I am, but acknowledging my responsibility in things. So I mentally apologize. Or if you can, contact the person and apologize. Then give everything you own away. Yeah? Because all your possessions are not going to be able to come with you when you die. And if you give them away now, you create merit out of generosity. After you're dead, people, they're going to get given away, but you can't create the merit. The other person creates the merit and dedicates it for you. But it's better if you know you're going to die, give it away yourself and create merit. Okay? And then take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Yeah? Remember your refuge. Remember the qualities of the Buddha. If you can hold in your mind the Buddha and the Buddha's qualities, negative karma can't ripen at that moment. Yeah, so that's very important. Or meditate on bodhicitta. Yeah, do the taking and giving meditation. Yeah, may I take on, even if, whatever it is, may I take on the fear or the pain or whatever of all people who are dying at this moment, and do the taking and giving meditation. Or remember a little bit about emptiness and just even say to yourself, if you have funny appearances, like hallucinations or funny dreamlike appearances, just say to yourself, it's just an appearance to the mind. It's not real. I don't need to be frightened. I don't need to cling. I don't need to push anything away. Yeah, it's just an appearance. I notice it. I go back to focusing on the Buddha. Yeah.
So if you don't have the time to practice, to do these things, Duck is right here. You're here. Duck is right here.
Yeah.
So at that moment, in that instant, the best thing to do would be to take refuge.
Yeah. Yeah. Think, bottom line, take refuge.
Try to let everything else go to, not get scared from the hallucinations. And
yeah. Right. Yeah. One of my teachers described it as a bird taking off in flight from a ship that's in the middle of the ocean. The bird takes off and it goes forward. It doesn't look back to the ship. So it's like, okay, I go forward with as much love and compassion and bodhicitta as I can recall at this moment, and I don't cling to anything from this life at all. Just let it go. Yeah.
Sort of a related question to that. Attachment, of course, is very, very powerful throughout our lives. And I'm just wondering, as you describe this process of dying, should one expect that the ability to give up attachment is any easier? Or is it always as difficult as it is right now?
I think it's as difficult as it is right now, which is why we need to practice giving it up right now. Yeah? And the same thing with anger. Practice giving up our anger right now. So even if we can't give up all of our attachment, give up a little bit. A little bit here, a little bit there, a little bit here, a little bit there. Like drops in a bucket, it gets bigger.
Mm-hmm. But as he got older, he got so generous that he started giving away other people's stuff.
Yeah, you just imagine the Buddha. And think of the Buddha, you know, and if you can just think of the Buddha surrounded by all the other Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. And think of the Buddha looking at you with total acceptance and compassion. Yeah? And just think of the Buddha's wonderful qualities and get in touch with your aspiration to become a Buddha. So let's sit quietly for a few minutes. So think about something you've heard. Practice it so you can remember it later and use it later. The merit that we created this evening as individuals and as a group. And let's send that out into the universe and dedicate it so that each sentient being can have a peaceful mind and heart, live peacefully together with others. Take refuge at the time of death. Generate bodhicitta. Realize the emptiness of inherent existence. And quickly become a Buddha. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May the born have no decline, but increase forevermore.